Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun, the podcast with your host, Tom Wilson, and guests from every corner of the places where Tom's been and asked to be on a show. Brought to you by Tom's Art at BigPopFun.com. Moving pictures to make you happy. Hey, support the arts by buying art. Tom, life, showbiz, people. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Tom Wilson here, the host of the Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson podcast. The podcast, so nice, the host has already named himself twice. Thanks so much for downloading it. Thanks for being here. I appreciate all the feedback. I appreciate the postcards, which are kind of neat thing. Old style, old school communication postcards to P.O. Box 18106, Encino, California, 91416, which is fun. But thanks for being here. Thanks for being here on another magical sleigh ride of entertainment, enchantment, and wonder as we glide here in our winter season over the snow-covered treetops and marvel at the twinkling Christmas lights on every house. Well, almost every house. Not almost every house. Look, hey, there are colorful twinkling lights on a few houses that still care about Christmas lights and aren't lazy people. Yes, we're marveling at the twinkling lights on some houses as children nestle near the computer screen and beg Santa again for another single shooter video game rated M for mature. Anyway, thanks for being What was that? Thanks for being on the podcast, brought to you by Art, as it always is. Hey, I'm plugging a friend's website today. Why not? He doesn't pay me. I don't even have a piece of art of his, but Dave Darrow is a great guy. He has a Ustream show himself called Dave the Painting Guy. Check out darrowart.com, DarrowArt.com. Dave is really one of the premier figurative painters in the country. Figurative painting, meaning painting people, painting portraits, painting dancers, painting all sorts of things. But his paintings are beautiful. And often he will put an original painting up on eBay. And as I say, you could buy a jewel for your house to place somewhere in the house. That's an original painting with the brush strokes on there. There is nothing like a painting which is both evocative of the scene that you're looking at, which is beautiful, but also if you look closely, it's evocative of the creative process of the painter who made it with the impasto paints, with the brush strokes and everything like that. It's also brought to you by my book, this podcast, The Masked Man. Hey, would you check it out? If you haven't checked it out already, all 5-star ratings so far. Now, don't go on there and give me a 4, please. I don't want to see that 5th star go to that half star thing on Amazon or on Apple when finally someone comes in going, yeah, it was pretty good, and they give it 4 stars, then you get this half star, and you're like, oh, man, it was all 5. So, but the point is, the book is doing well, and I appreciate that very much. More than it's doing well, which is fine. I mean, that helps me out, and that helps out with the podcast and everything. But more than that, a lot of people like get where I'm coming from in their reactions to the book and their emails to me and stuff. And that really means the world to me. And that's what the book was all about, of course, to communicate some of myself, as this podcast does. So The Masked Man, it's called. It's available for iPad and Kindle and Nook and every kind of e-publishing platform. Many people are asking me for a physical copy of the book right now. That's not happening because it's prohibitively expensive to make gigantic stacks of physical books and then carry them around places where I'm performing. And then at the end of the show, lift up a book and say, hey, you want to buy a book for $10 or something? And then people don't buy it. And then I have to ship books back with me. So do you understand that? Yeah. So for right now, no plans. I'm back from Dayton, Ohio. I'm trying to make these introductions a bit shorter. I'm back from Dayton, Ohio. I had a wonderful time, and thanks to the fabulous people of Dayton, Ohio, I stayed in downtown Dayton, which I think has been used for some kind of neutron bomb testing, or it's deserted. There is no one in downtown Dayton. There's a guy at a Subway restaurant, one kid who was a couple blocks away from my hotel, who sat there looking at sliced ham plaintively, and, you know, gave a sigh when I came in, like, oh, another person. So I don't know. The club manager would pick me up to do radio and do TV spots and things like that. And I'd say, what is with, I mean, downtown Dayton? It's, you know, he said, well, the GM plant pulled out and this thing and that thing. And then he just starts to point out these buildings that are just deserted. Look at that office building right there. Nobody's in it. So anyway, I was the one guy for that weekend in downtown Dayton, where I was performing at the Funny Bone, which is a great club in the suburbs of Dayton, in the rolling green hills of Ohio, as one of these, you know, the suburban big destination shopping experience places. You know what I'm talking about. It's kind of an outdoorsy, indoorsy thing. I don't know what, you know, I don't go to those places a lot. I perform in them now because outside many cities, some industrialists went to the outer reaches of Dayton, looked over the green rolling hills of Ohio with the children gambling about on the green hills. And then they thought, we don't need children gambling about on green hills. We need their parents who will come to us with their Visa cards for Forever 21 and Restoration Hardware stuff. So they... Yes. So the first industrialist said, let's cover the hills in concrete as far as the eye can see. We'll plant two trees and call it the Green. So I performed at the Green all weekend long. I walked to the Argonne District in Dayton, Ohio, went to the 5th Street Deli, which I recommend if you like a good sandwich and eating that sandwich while your elbows touch the person next to you at the opposite table, because it's very crowded. It's a very small space there in the Argonne District in Dayton, which is nearly deserted except for the 5th Street Deli. There are a lot of elbows that are available there to touch your elbows, but they were good sandwiches. I had a club sandwich, not the club sandwich that you're thinking of, that I've actually eaten 7 trillion of in my lifetime, because it's kind of, no matter what hotel you're in around the country, they kind of can't ruin a club sandwich, so I order a lot of them. This club sandwich was different. It was like made by a chef. It was like something like a club sandwich that they would make in Top Chef, and you're going to Aspen. That was a good club sandwich, but I did eat the club sandwich touching a man who was sitting next to me eating his sandwich. So, okay, that I would give. I would cut 1 star. I would give them the half a star, and I would give them 4 stars, which would cut them their 5 to that half one. So I went back. I had a chicken salad sandwich there. Odd. You ever have one of those chicken salad sandwiches that's kind of like fruity? Some chicken salad, like the chicken salad with an occasional piece of grape or something. Okay, it's a little essence, a little hint of something else. This chicken salad was, I think, pretty confused. It didn't know who it was. The sandwich came on raisin cinnamon toast and kind of a fruity chicken salad with a salty thing. Look, Winston Churchill once was at a restaurant and sent a pudding back to the chef saying, this pudding has no theme. So I got, you know, it lacks a theme. The sandwich couldn't decide what it was. It had celery in it. Celery. It had celery in the chicken salad with kind of like fruit. I don't know. Think about this. Celery and cinnamon raisin toast. See? I told you. I was on a TV show, Living Dayton, which is what we all should do, I think. Ever since I've been on the show, I've really been trying to live Dayton in my life. I've taken it back to Los Angeles, and I am living Dayton because I was on the show. I came onto the set of the show, and there was the two ladies, the two hosts of the show. One was doing a segment over on this kind of set, and it was, I don't know what she was discussing, but there was a table in front of her, and this other lady was on the other set, the more the sort of sofa-like set. But there were two empty chairs. There was an empty chair with the one host, and there was an empty chair with the other host. So I came to the set and I said, "Oh, which one am I going to?" And they said, "Oh, over here. You're doing it with Suri." So I went over there, and then the other host is just looking at me with an empty chair next to her. And I said, "Oh, well, that's good. I mean, we've left a chair for Elijah," which I just absently said that, you know, a little Elijah joke. She says, "It's that obvious I'm Jewish?" What? We're coming back from a commercial. So they're like, 5, 4, coming back. And she says, "It's that obvious I'm Jewish?" So we're coming back from this commercial. Everybody's looking at me like I made some, you know, anti-Semitic reference when I just said, you've left a place for Elijah, because it was an empty chair. So don't ask me. I'm the, I'm the anti-Semitic guest from Living Dayton, which has really wrecked my Living Dayton that day. But from then on, you know, I'm Living Dayton. Speaking of anti-Semitic references, Jeff Harlan is my guest this week. Jeff is, I don't know what anti-Semitic reference. Jeff is actually Semitic. Yes, he is. He is. And his lovely parents, whom I've been friends with for so long, who passed away this year, well into their 90s. God bless their hearts. And they'd been married for 76 years. Jeff and I talk about that a little bit. But Jeff's a wonderful guy. Jeff is a very talented musician, works all over Southern California as a guitarist and a singer. But why I was so interested in him is he is really one of the top guys of commercial acting. He came here. He's done a lot of acting in sitcoms, in drama shows, and everything. But he's one of those guys that has done hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of television commercial for tires, for jackets, for Sears, for airlines, for whatever he has worked at. So we talked about that. He is he's a very, very busy voiceover talent. He's the official announcer of Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the podcast. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with my friend Jeff Harlan.
Well, hello, Tommy.
Jeff Harlan is my guest.
Hey, Tom.
From Harlan Industries here in wherever we are. We're in Van Nuys, California. We're at an undisclosed
Sherman Oaks.
Is this officially Sherman Oaks?
This is Sherman Oaks.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Didn't mean to.
We were rezoned. People go, "Wow, wait, Van Nuys, that's Victory and Balboa?"
So, did you, where did you grow up? Where did you grow up? Here?
LA.
Not in this house, I mean.
Not in this house, no, thank God. Would have been tight. But
you're an LA guy.
Yes. A native, grew up around Olympic and La Brea for probably up until the fifth grade, then moved over by the Olympic and Fairfax area.
Really?
So that's
what
maybe
that?
It.
Well, Olympic and Fairfax, that's a very Jewish area,
yes.
We could say. Cantor's Deli
Cantor's
over that Deli way
on,
and many.
Yeah, a lot of delis, a lot of bakeries. Yes, it was definitely now, it's still very, very Jewish, but it's I think I could have sworn I saw a sign like Little Saigon or something.
Really?
But I don't think it was that close.
Is it politically correct for me to be able to say it's a Jewish area?
I think so.
Okay.
I'm not offended.
Jews are not up in arms now?
No, I don't think so. Let's hope not.
No.
But we'll find out.
I love the
When does this air?
Hebrew Americans.
Yeah,
I love
right.
it. And I go to Cantor's. Now I haven't been to Cantor's in years.
But I know that you've gone to Cantor's.
Oh, I've been to Cantor's many times.
Yes.
Many times.
It's still the same. I was here not long ago, and it's still
I celebrate the food of the Jewish people.
Right, right. Yeah, that whole area. Now, the area you're describing by Cantor's is further north, but that's around. I went to high school right up the street from Cantor's, to Fairfax High School.
Wow. I was in Cantor's once. I don't think it was the last time, but one of the final times. I mean, this was a long time ago. It was I had dinner there, a very late night dinner after comedy, with Arsenio Hall and Keenan Ivory Wayans.
Oh, wow.
And me. And the dinner, this was before either of them did anything, really.
Right.
We were just young comics.
Oh, wow.
And we were in Cantor's, and Arsenio Hall and Keenan Wayans were spending their time telling me how like big of a star I was going to be.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I'm like, what are you guys crazy? I mean, we're all good, you know? No, but they're like, you know, but, you know, I don't know. I was, but I was the white guy.
Yeah.
I didn't know that we'd be unhip right. suddenly, that it would be finished.
Right.
But Cantor's is a very, very famous deli that's very late night and that so many comics and actors eat at.
And it's one of those places, it's funny when you were telling that story, because I would go there so often late at night and see many comics coming in as yourself, like yourself. And I remember one night at Cantor's, for your audience, just info, they have a microphone where an elderly woman will sit there and go, "Wilson, party of three." You know,
is that the same woman from around the country?
You know,
I think she gets in a van.
She does,
and goes to New York delis, to every deli.
She does. She even for a small amount of time was doing "Where's the Beef?"
Yes, yeah. Dr. Goldberg, right. Party of Six.
She gets around.
Yeah,
and but she was a comic, and it was very funny. She was going like, "Wilson, party of three," and the comic would answer, "Wilson, party of three." And then she's hearing this after a few times, and she's going, "You know, that's not very funny." You know, that's not very funny. And she, of course, he's yelling it out. She's doing it on a loudspeaker, and it was a cute moment. But yes, Cantor's, my parents, who were married, they were together 78 years, but they celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary at Cantor's.
What was that, 1931 or something?
That was, I think, 61 or something like
that. 25th anniversary. Wow. Your parents were together for 78 years.
78 years. They were married 76 years. They passed this year, as you know. But they had an incredible long life together and just in love.
I remember, of course, their lovely funerals, both of their funerals.
Right.
They passed not too long, one after another, right. as sometimes happens in
of
a relationship
course.
Like that.
And at 94 and 95.
Of course. Yeah. But I just still remember the rabbi at the funeral
mm-hmm.
saying, "Now, they were married for 76 years," and he just pauses and says, "Let me say that again."
Yeah, right.
76 years.
It's so true.
Of marriage.
Yeah.
That's that is amazing. But your mom and dad are great people. Great people.
Yeah,
God rest their souls. But 78 right. years together. Now, what'd your dad do?
Well, initially, my dad, you know, we were always the lower middle class. He worked three jobs. He was a truck driver during the day. And then at night, he would take odd jobs if he could. But on the weekend, it was mostly for, I remember my early childhood, my dad worked for a van lines called Republic Van Lines here in L.A. And then on the weekend, he'd go and deliver pizza supplies up the coast to Santa Barbara, Fresno. And occasionally, my brother and I would get to go with him just for the weekend trip.
Like a van full of dough or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, it was dough. It was tomato sauce. It was cheese.
So you would have just a pizza supply delivery guy.
Yes.
Just to various pizzerias.
Right. But for us, it was a road trip because we didn't get to go on very many vacations or trips. So
uh-huh.
it was, you know, those memories are, you know, just so priceless to me. But yeah, we would go up. If we went up to Fresno or Bakersfield, that was wow.
What was it? Was a van or a truck? You'd
no,
be in a
he,
truck with
he
dad?
It was a truck. It wasn't a large one. It was bigger than a van. It would be your average like small U-Haul truck that you
mm-hmm.
might rent to. Okay, we're going to move an apartment.
Right.
So my brother and myself and my dad would be there in the cab, and it was just like a thrill. I mean,
did you eat a lot of pizza?
You know,
did you get free slices when you were at the pizzeria?
No, you
wouldn't get any free pizza.
If we did, you know, that's a great question, Tom, because I can't remember I don't recall us ever getting free pizza. My dad would drop it off. We'd usually wait in the cab you know, and then we'd move on to the next drop off. And
but that's a beautiful drive. So early memories of yours are dad driving the truck up the coast to Santa Barbara.
Right.
And he a truck full of dough and tomato sauce.
That's right. And then later, probably when I was maybe, I won't even date myself here. But my dad had before I was born, he had a hardware store. He was originally from Chicago and he came out here. My uncle, who was a lawyer, also had some other investments and he had a hardware store that he let my dad run. And years later, my dad ended up getting a partner and opening up his own hardware store out here in the valley in Van Nuys. And not far from where we are right now at Woodman and Oxnard. And for anyone who's listening to this that's local, that building is still there. And every time I drive by it, I think of my dad pulling out the wheelbarrows and the shovels and stuff like that that he put on display in the front of the store. Mm-hmm. He had that hardware store up until about 1975. So he had it at least 20 years from what I could recall. And I never wanted any – I mean, I dropped by to see him, but now I wish that I would have hung out there and learned about how to pipe and how to, rescreen a door and, all those things my dad knew that I have to hire people to do because I'm so afraid I'm going to mess it up.
But what in high school – now, I know this about you, that you're – you're a great musician and everything. School, did you start – in music, or were you in plays, or what were your interests in high school? I mean, what took you on that path?
Boy, interesting. In LA, well, this could be anywhere, but in Los Angeles, especially.
But you must say, Los Angeles in the 60s was just a hotbed. I mean, you can't imagine. I didn't live here, but I know from the very few friends that I have that were around here who were, sort of concert goers or musicians. I mean, you could see amazing things.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was such a hotbed of creativity.
And the distractions for any kid who's in school. I mean, there were a lot of kids who never went to school. When I was in high school, I missed a lot of high school.
Where'd you go?
I went to Fairfax High. Where did I go?
Yeah, you'd cut Fairfax what?
Yeah, I would just do any hang out. Sometimes we would, obviously because we still lived at home, I couldn't go home, but we'd go to a friend's house whose mother might work all day or whatever if there were, just no father in the family.
Play Joni Mitchell albums or what did you do?
We would, it was called high school. we participated in, we would get high a lot.
And things. Okay. Yeah, all right. Fine. California, I suppose,
right,
in the California. 60s.
Yeah, it was L.A. I mean, it
you
was
just
not,
put on what the Inagata DeVita, like the one side with the drum solo.
Or, you'd go to a black light shop.
Yeah, sure. Of course.
And you'd hang out and you'd look at all these posters.
Just go, whoa,
the Mandela,
man.
Or whatever. Yeah. And just listen to this music and think, wow, this is what life really is about. Sitting here we wouldn't be smoking a joint then, but if I could say that, can I say that?
You'd be sitting there high staring at some
poster.
Hippie poster in black light.
It laid black
just
light.
Going,
that's right.
This is what it's all about.
This is what it's all about, yeah. And, of course, that's the naivete of a kid who should be spending more time in school. But we at that time especially, it's funny, when at Fairfax, we had our share of celebrities that would come and go, but I'll never forget, I had just gotten to Fairfax and starting the 10th grade, and this beat-up VW van comes driving in with Indiana license plates, and the family's name were, painted along the side, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, okay, so here's another one of those family groups that are...
Like it was decorated?
Oh,
like
yeah,
it was,
yes.
It's so the side of a van.
Yes, side of the van, like their typical advertisement. And like 6 months later, I Want You Back came out as a single, and it was the Jackson 5.
The van drove up to Fairfax
saying
High.
The Jackson
saying
5.
The Jackson 5 on the side of the van.
Indiana license plates. And I remember having that thought, oh, yeah, here's a family, thinks they're going to make it here in show business. And Tito and Jackie, the two older brothers, went to Fairfax when I was there. Michael, I don't know where Michael might have been. I know Jermaine was at Bancroft Junior High, which was there in Hollywood.
Michael probably went to a special school.
He might have.
I think he was taught by unicorns.
Maybe.
Yeah, and leprechauns.
Maybe,
in a very special colony.
Yeah, maybe he hung out at Disneyland or something.
I have no idea. But can you imagine Michael Jackson at that time, you know, in school?
It is. Someone told me they thought he and Marlon did go to Bancroft at some point. But I remember when they bought their place out on Havenhurst in Encino.
Sure.
I was going to lead into another story, but when they bought that place in Encino, they started coming to school in a limo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that no more VW van. But and the school was so proud. I mean, when we would play at our lunchtime, they'd play "I Want You Back" repeatedly on the loudspeakers.
Oh, because the Jacksons went to school there.
Yes, and we were just so proud to Jackson 5 go to our.
Well, that's that California thing.
Yeah,
the Jackson 5 came to your school.
That's right.
And I mean, to go to school there.
Yeah.
And what was your other story? You have other what other famous people?
No.
What other name dropping things do we have from Fairfax High in Los Angeles?
At Fairfax, I mean, we had I guess every school would have assemblies where you'd have a guest speaker or whatever. We would have rock groups come. We had the Grassroots. I don't know if you remember who they were. We had Poco.
Came to do assembly.
Yeah. Did a concert.
Did a concert.
Yeah. I mean, when I say, and the concert was only an hour long.
Right. Because you had to get to lunch or whatever.
Right. But the Byrds played at Fairfax, too. Before I was there, I would have killed to have seen them.
Oh, you missed? Before you were there, the Byrds went?
Yeah, they were there the year before when I was in eighth grade. But my brother got to see them.
Uh-huh.
I was going to say that there was a cousin. It was a cousin who played in the band of the Jacksons, and I'm thinking his name. There were Jackie, Tito, Johnny was his name, and Johnny had played with them. I guess up until he got busted breaking into a house, which was I'm thinking you're in the Jackson 5. Why are you?
Yeah, they're doing very well.
That's right,
Johnny. You're going to school in a limo,
right?
And so why blow things?
He was out of the band after that. It just made me think of, I wonder whatever happened to him. But who knows?
Wow.
But the Jacksons did pretty well.
What did you do? When did you start playing music?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you did ask me that. I had started playing when I was in elementary school, when the Beatles came out.
Did you buy your own guitar? Did Dad get you a guitar?
My parents got me my first guitar. They got me a classical guitar. And then I had that for a few years. I took two lessons and learned how to look at a chord book and make out chords with the tablature. But really the way I learned was getting Beatle records, playing a little bit, lifting up the needle, trying to hear where the open strings were, what notes seemed to be. Is there a finger on that string, and as opposed to this one ringing through? And it took a lot of time, but it taught me how to play by ear. But and that was it. I never had lessons, but I early on was able to play all the Beatles stuff, and then all the British Invasion stuff, which was such a influence on my life. So I don't know that I ever thought I'd wanted to be a professional musician. I played in bands, but it was more for fun, never really thinking that, like today where every kid could, let's get it on YouTube and let's see if we could generate some kind of...
It's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's a totally different world.
You just go to Guitar Center, pick up a guitar, go to YouTube, find out how to begin... Sweet Home Alabama.
Oh, yeah.
It's like wild.
Even now, I mean, as you know, we were talking about it, I've started going back to, just for fun, some open mic nights. And I am seeing so many with kids there's this one kid who I think is 12 years old, very talented guitar player and singer, and his dad is right there videoing every performance this kid does. And I already see it that they're going to be throwing all this stuff up on YouTube, and where it seems it's I don't know if I should say it's easier, but it really does seem like it is a lot easier for people who wouldn't have maybe had a hope to, you know, get, you know, it's luck, you know, if to get to a record company, to get a record deal. It is, you know, there are hundreds of thousands that never will get that opportunity. But YouTube, I think, really does open that door for a lot of people, just to,
especially if dad's taping you everywhere you go and everything you do.
Right.
I mean, it'll eventually, you know, destroy your love of the thing.
Yeah, that's true.
And you'll throw your guitar out the window and say, "I hate you, Dad. Yeah. I never want to see a guitar again."
Yeah.
But for now, at least dad's helping you get sort of famous, which is really the important thing.
Right.
Let's face it, not the love of music.
Right.
But you started working pretty fast out of school. I mean, you were a young actor who, let's face it, I think was quite fortunate.
Oh, I was very fortunate.
What happened right out of school? Like, what was your first few things? Commercials?
No, actually, they were sitcoms. My first thing was a... my very first thing, the job that got me my SAG card was a film called The First Nudie Musical. And Bruce Kimmel wrote and directed.
It was a movie.
It was a movie, a Paramount picture with Cindy Williams. Ron Howard was in it. A guy named Steve Nathan, who's now a big producer. And there were a lot of Didi Canova. Diana Canova used to be a regular, I think, on Soap. It was rated X when it first came out because there was nudity in it. But I played a dancing dildo. And that
was your first job.
That's
your
what
first
got,
professional job.
That was my first professional job that got me my SAG card. And I do have to say that I was playing in a band for a year at that time, and we were really close to getting a record deal. They did get the record deal after I left the band. It wasn't me that was holding them back.
Really?
But
the dancing gig blew it for you, though.
That's
they
right.
Saw the movie. I don't think so, Joe.
Well, you know, once I got my SAG card, I kind of thought, you know, when we were in this band, I kept, since I was not the songwriter, I wasn't the lead singer, I felt so replaceable when we would get guys coming to check.
You're kind of a rhythm guitarist.
Yeah, rhythm guitarist, sang backup.
Yeah.
And when and of course I had been acting, you know, also through that time, and I was thinking, but not professionally, but I was thinking, geez, as an actor, I've got myself, my personality, that I definitely stand out from. You know, I thought I had more going for me as an actor than a musician.
For them being a rhythm guitarist in a band that might or might not get a recording deal. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So you're doing more sitcoms and stuff?
Well, my first gig, it was The First Nudie Musical. And then I got an agent, and my first gig was a starring role in this NBC pilot called Instant Family. And it was a couple of the producers from All in the Family created this pilot. And in this show, I got to co-write with a songwriter named Jeff Barry the theme song for the show. And the show was gearing – it was geared – it was kind of like the premise was – Odd Couple with Kids, but it's two divorced guys with their kids, and the son of one guy and myself, I played William Daniel's son, and we were forming a band within the show. So the show was going to try to market us as young.
As a band.
Yes.
As New Monkeys.
A duo.
Of,
yes.
A duo thing.
Yeah, two guys. And but unfortunately, it didn't happen. It came close. I mean,
did it air?
Yeah, the pilot aired. We did it. It came within a week of getting. You know, we had our time slot. We were gonna, you know, start production, and let me get this right. I think it was ABC dropped The Bionic Woman, and NBC bought it. And said, you know what? We're going to shelve you for 6 months, and we're going to...
Lindsay Wagner destroyed your music career?
That's right. She just stole my thunder.
Her and her little mattress.
Can you believe that?
What's your sleep number, Lindsay Wagner?
Right.
Well, Jeff's music number is zero because of you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
that's
super
right.
Bionic hearing.
Yeah.
Who cares about bionic hearing? At least Steve Austin had, you know, legs.
He could run
60.
Her legs weren't bad.
I don't mean attractiveness, Jeff.
Oh,
I'm not saying.
Sorry.
I'm not saying.
I went there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm not saying that Steve Austin, astronaut's legs, you know, were not. I'm saying I didn't pay a lot of attention to their attractiveness.
Of course you did.
I'm saying they were fast.
That's right.
He could run 60.
He could.
That's all I know.
How fast could she run?
She? I don't know. I don't know. She had different skills.
Her arms did that side to side thing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. She did girly 70s
running.
Didn't
look as good.
Like, yeah. Girls run better now, I think.
I think so.
Than Lindsay Wagner.
Oh, yeah. Back then, they didn't know how to run.
They didn't know in the 70s.
Right.
They just had their bionic hearing.
Well, I think they still do.
They do.
Yeah. I get in trouble many times.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I think you're right about that. So you were working all this stuff. But then, you know, I guess I'm interested in what is the – what changed over – to get you booked on hundreds upon hundreds of national commercials? Because really, when I met you, yes, you were working as an actor, and you were doing something on this sitcom and that sitcom.
Right.
But you were the man as far as commercials went. And everyone knew it. Everyone knew. I mean, would go in. It's TWA around the world. It's whatever. It's tires. It's beer. It's whatever it was. And Jeff goes in and just booked it.
You know,
when did that start happening?
You know, that it started pretty early on. I was really lucky with commercials. I think part of it being I came from an improv background at first. And back then, even though it's kind of getting back to that now in commercials, but for a long time, well, in the beginning, they were fine with you throwing in lines, making a joke better, changing the copy if you had something better, and many times you would. And I felt that was my strong suit at that time, being able to make something funny and stand out where a lot of actors would just kind of do it as written. And but I also think being I was blonde, kind of had that, you know, I had a lot more hair than I do have now, but that John Ritter kind of thing going for me. And it was just, I think it was a commercial look along with just.
Did it ever occur to you that things were going really well, or were you just kind of riding a tiger that you thought, well, I guess I'm just getting cast in this stuff? Or did you believe, like, boy, this is going well?
No, I believed things were going well. I mean, you know, I would it seems like when you start, sometimes it counts against you, but especially in commercials, once you have a few things on the air, all of a sudden, and they're noticing you in ad agencies, oh, here's a working guy. Oh, I like this guy. All of a sudden, it brings you
more. Oh, it's the snowball starts rolling.
Yeah, it's a snow. But then you have that, you reach that place where they're kind of, even though the, you know, average guy on the street wouldn't necessarily go, oh, you're the TWA guy, or you're the McDonald's guy, or you're the Goodyear guy. They would go, God, you seem familiar, but I don't know, where would I know you from? And but ad agencies were so fearful that they're going to think that you are recognized for one product, and then they wouldn't want to touch you for a while.
So you become sort of saturated within the commercial market.
Right.
And then when suddenly you're on every commercial, and then they start going, yeah, he's the guy on every commercial. Let's not have him do this.
But I do have to say that for me didn't really happen until I probably hit all well into my 300 plus commercials, where I remember Mike Lean, a commercial casting director, would send my agent the breakdowns. And for your audience, a breakdown is when they're casting a commercial, they'll have
we'll say young guy in sports car.
Right.
You know, we want 20 to 27.
Right. And they might go, Tom, in this case, it was a Tom Hanks, Peter Scolari, Jeff Harlan type. Mm-hmm. You know, and now I was so honored to be thrown in that, you know, lumped with Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
what's the matter with Peter Scolari?
Nothing. I was very proud. I love Peter. Peter, and I truly do love Peter. Nothing's wrong with Peter.
I'm just teasing you.
No, but
we're both friends of Peter's. Right. Peter's a wonderful guy.
Right. I just thought it. Yeah, that's true.
You mentioned him to Hanks.
That's right.
Movie
that's
star.
Right. That's
I've
true.
Got to drop the movie star name.
That's true.
You're looking out for you, Scolari.
Yeah, he is, and I guess you've proven you're a better friend to Peter than I am.
So your thing about being cast in commercials at that time was a free improvisational approach to the audition.
Yeah, I do have to say that whether this truly helped or not, I did take it very seriously at that time.
Of course.
I mean, I would watch other commercials. I'd get a sense of, you know, back then you would have the major, like your Gray Advertising, Saatchi and Saatchi, these big companies. You would get a sense of the style of their spots. When I would go to the market, I'd look. I know this is taking – these are just commercials, but I would literally look at the products I was buying and go – oh, Tide, that's if it happened to be Procter & Gamble, or, you know, Charmin is Procter & Gamble, or, you know, and notice, okay, and their style is this, and this, and that really helped me a lot. I felt book a lot more than, you know, when I would, at my height, I was booking one in five. If I had five auditions, I'd book one commercial.
Which is just ridiculously good.
It is very good.
For commercials.
Yes.
Because they're so good.
It's usually one in 30.
Very picky. And the final audition for that commercial for Tide or whatever, I mean, there are all these suits there and these people with, you know, all of the business people are there, and they're just waiting for you to make that one little mistake. Oh, I don't know, Ted. Do you really think? And then you don't get it.
Right.
No?
Oh, I you know, I remember Ava Shevitt, a big commercial casting director, told me the story one time. I had booked this Wausau insurance commercial, and a fellow actor, Jamie Anders, very handsome guy. It was between the two of us, and Ava had told me, Jeff, I got to tell you how you booked this. When we were watching the final tape, it was down to you and Jamie. They were watching it, and one of the clients said, you know, Jeff Harlan, he's kind of got a big nose. And this voice went, book Jeff Harlan. And it was the head client who had a big nose.
Oh, so, the guy, so the president of the company or whatever.
That's right.
Had the big nose. Somebody says, he has kind of a big nose. Book him. I like him.
That's right. And I said to Jamie, who was, you know, I haven't seen Jamie in years, but he was a friend. I said, Jamie, I beat you by a nose. You know, it was just.
Wow.
So, and that's what it is. In commercials, I mean, you know, in our business, so often it doesn't matter how good you are. It's you might lose it because, oh, you look like my friend who owes me money or my.
Exactly.
You know. And
too tall, too short, too big, whatever.
It's
the wrong shirt.
Right.
You didn't wear this shirt, and that guy wore it. Whatever. There's so many.
So you have
variables.
To not really take it too seriously.
And you know what? What I'm very interested in is at that point when you were working a lot out of Los Angeles, you decided to move to New York City to study more acting.
Yeah,
you decided to really. You gave up a lot. I mean, it was quite a significant risk.
Yeah.
In the interest of bettering yourself as an actor, you just – I mean, you had the money. You were working a lot.
Right.
So you had the money to go to New York, an expensive city, and get an apartment and everything. But you went back to study – you studied with Sandy Meisner, didn't you?
Yeah.
At the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Neighborhood Playhouse. And
what was about that decision? I mean, what brought you to that?
Well, I was, like I said, I had started doing sitcoms. I started doing, did that Instant Family, and then I got, did a few Mork and Mindy's, got to do the very first Mork and Mindy. And Robin.
You were in the pilot?
Yeah. The
pilot was on Happy Days.
Yes, was on Happy Days. Mm-hmm. But we did, in those days, they would do, every sitcom every year would have or I shouldn't say everyone, but at least the Paramount ones would have, their first show would be an hour special. And then they would have their, normally the show would be a half hour show. You know what? And I'm wrong there. I'm thinking of the hour story was actually a Taxi story, I was going to tell you, the hour special. The first show of Mork and Mindy was a half hour show. And Robin and I were at Harvey Lembeck's. Harvey was, I know you had Ned Gill on.
Who talked about Harvey's class, very famous class with Robin Williams and John LaRoquette and so many great
John Ritter,
comic actors. Yeah, John Ritter.
It was a great time that I wish I took more seriously at that time as far as appreciating it. But it was a wonderful time with the talent that was in those classes where we would just perform and, you know, do our improv. And I didn't know that Robin was Mork, and I saw Robin on set. He didn't recommend me for the role. I just auditioned and got it. But when I saw Robin, I said, Robin, I see him in this uniform, and I said, what are you doing here? He goes, well, I'm Mork. And I said, oh, yeah, of course. And then I remembered that he did the Happy Days, and that's what Mork and Mindy was. I wasn't putting the two together because I didn't know who's Mindy, you know,
right,
that time. But yeah, it was, I got to play Mindy's, boyfriend, and in the very opening of the show, I'm with Mindy on a date. Mork is landing on Earth in the egg, and,
But you know, if you're Mindy's boyfriend and the show is called Mork and Mindy, yeah, I don't know how many times you're going to recur on the show.
Yeah.
I think you're going to, yeah, I think you're on your way out.
5 minutes and you're done.
5 minutes, you're just, yeah, we're calling it Mork and Mindy.
That's
Jeff,
right.
Thanks
yeah,
so much for coming in.
Yeah, and I'm still waiting for that call, but I think it's gone.
But at that time on sitcoms, what did you want to do? Did you want to deepen the way that you create characters, or?
Well, I mean, no, why I left when I went to
why you went to New York and Sandy Meisner?
Because I could not get arrested for a drama. I did, I think, one episode of Chips, and it was somewhat dramatic.
Well, that's drama. Yeah,
right.
That's drama. When Eric Estrada is riding a motorcycle, I mean, we're talking drama.
Of course. But it was just after that, I just thought, you know what? I cannot get arrested for dramas. I'd love to do them. And like you said, I could easily afford to take the time off. And I thought, I'm going to go to New York, you know, get this training, come back even better and stronger. And
so
you know,
did you study with Sandy himself?
No. Joanne Barron, who's out here now. But it was funny. I had studied with her. And back then, there were a lot of also Wynne Hanman. I'm trying to think of some of these names. It's been a while since I thought about it. But no, I didn't study with Sandy. That would have been a thrill. But for me, though, it was also growing up in L.A., I'd never been to New York. I wouldn't trade this experience for, you know, just going there, being there. The drag was they wouldn't allow me to work. When you study at the Neighborhood Playhouse, they don't allow you to work professionally. And
which is why a lot of people who study there just don't seem to be very good.
Right,
because people start getting gigs and leaving.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's like music. It's like, you know, music study. It's like, I'm sorry, I missed the final.
Right.
I had a gig.
Exactly.
You know?
And even though you weren't supposed to, I did manage to work in some voiceover gigs at that time, but I couldn't take off a day of, you know, to go shoot something. Or
New York was an exciting place to live. Did the study help you?
Yeah, it did help me a lot.
What aspect would you say?
It just, you know, at the time, you know how you could study with a lot. I've studied with a lot of great teachers. And if, you know, what you draw upon is it's not just one thing. It's not all Stella Adler. Or it's not all, you know, Harvey Lembeck, or it's not all Sandy Meisner. But it just adds to your little file of, you know, how to do or approach stuff. What I felt the Meisner work was great for. Now, I never did the Strasberg work, but it just seemed a healthier way of using your imagination emotionally, which leaves you endless possibilities of, you know, if I had to use my parents' death to draw on tears, let's say, in a short amount of time, especially if I'm doing a show night after night, that's going to dry up, that image. So
which is a more Strasbergian, more method is I must connect with something that actually happened to me and try to sort of revisit my emotions there and then shift those emotions to the situation of whatever it is, of my dog that's been hit by a car on an episode of Chips.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yours, which you found better, which worked for you better, was how would you describe that?
Well, it would be, you'd use an as if. It would be as if my parents died, or as if my child was run over by a, you know, as if. Now, I don't have kids, so, you know, I'd have to make that up. But there are so many things that you could still use that are from your imagination, because so often you're just sitting around, and I'm sure you've done it. Your fantasy, you feel your stomach in a knot because of just some thought you're having, and it's not even reality-based.
Right. I think that is the place of those sensitive people, of artists. Do you think everyone can do that?
it can do.
Can have such an active imagination, and to have that world so available to them that they can make that an as if my parent died, or as if my daughter was in an accident, or as if, and take all of those things in your imagination and act them out.
You know, I think we it's inherent in all of us, especially as kids, when we pretend. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. you've got kids, you know, it's I think we can all do it. I think it's just as we get older and go through life, when we get really into our middle age and so forth, we're really open to these emotions and stuff. But even as you get into your teens, you start suppressing a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not going to cry over this. I don't want to be a crybaby. Or right. I don't want to this or that. But I think everyone can, I think, as kids, with pretend.
Yeah.
Now, maybe.
Oh, I think you're right. I know. I agree with you. But, and I think that most bad acting isn't about just bad acting or the inability to get an emotion across. Most bad acting is just out of fear.
Right.
Is what if I really do it and I'm humiliated?
Yeah.
You know, what if I go to that place and everyone laughs at me?
Right.
That would hurt too much.
Right.
So I'm going to stay back
right.
and do a facsimile of that thing. And no one will react to it very strongly,
right.
but at least I'll be safe.
Yeah, because it's just not as honest. And,
yeah.
And you know, it's so for, again, I'm not, I do want to say this, that to not at all put down the method.
Oh, let's put it down. Come on.
No, Jeff. Well.
You want to put it down. You're just afraid that people will listen here, and then they'll come up to you going, Jeff, what was that?
Right.
This and the method.
Yeah.
And then if they beat you up, then you'll have a method thing to remember for the next time you're in a scene where you get beaten up.
Oh, you know, that's a
good thinking.
Good thinking. Thanks.
No, Tom. You're not dissing the method.
No.
Look, the bottom line, if I may overtalk you, I'm sorry about this.
No,
but man, isn't it whatever works?
It's true. It's true. And I think, you know, I look at, again, not blaming, you know, the method, but I remember my time even in New York. There was an actor, James Hayden, I think was his name. I think it was Hayden. He was a up-and-comer, was doing, I think, Pacino had kind of found him. He was doing a play with Pacino, and I should remember this play, but in the play, he was a drug addict. And apparently, James was really using for his, you know, character, and he ended up ODing. And it's a life cut short.
Congratulations.
Well, again, like taking it to the extreme of, you know, now I'm putting that, he might have had his problems with drugs beforehand, but I just remember I had met him a couple of times and he was one of those just James Dean-ish kind
right,
of, you know,
right.
Intense kind of actors that, you know,
and you won't say it, but allow me to, okay. Because I'm unafraid.
You're you.
I'm unafraid of those because if it works for you, that is fine. But I think it's destroyed more acting careers than it's built because that behavior has made you late for your call, or that behavior has made you so distracted that you couldn't perform the scene properly, or that behavior has spent so much time trying to get everyone to pay attention to the method that you use and think of you as a great actor,
right.
that when it comes down to it, in the scene, on the day, it's not there.
Yeah. Even though, and the wacky thing about our business, there are some actors who get totally rewarded for that.
Well, of course,
you know, behavior.
Well, of course, that's and music, that, and
right.
the arts will always the,
right.
the you know the inscrutable, the impossible to understand artiste who never showers and who just screams at people. He must be a genius,
right? Yeah,
he must never shower. He stinks.
He stinks.
Look at his hair.
Yeah.
It's a
and
nest
it doesn't
of rats.
Bother him. Right.
Let's hire him again.
Yeah.
He's got to be great.
Right.
But we'll finish our big method acting talk now.
That,
no, it's fine. But, you know, I had studied so long, like you, so many classes and so many different things and keeping these experiences of mine and all that stuff. And I met David Keith, the actor, mm-hmm. who at that time, David was working a lot of things in Brubaker and many, many movies. And it was a thrill for me, who was working in little plays and nightclubs and things, to meet like a guy from movies.
Right.
He worked in, you know, a movie with Robert Redford.
Oh, yeah.
So I the young acting student who's been in every class and everything. I've got all my methods and my all my acting books and all my stuff. And so I begin to ask him, like, what is, when you approach the scene, I mean, how did you approach that? From what, you know, he says, man, I just make it real and do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what do you mean? Yeah, I just, you know, make it real and do it.
It's true.
Like if you're in a scene in a kitchen when you're upset with somebody, all right, you're in a kitchen, you're upset with them.
Right.
So be upset with them. Let's right. see what happens.
Right.
A lot of times that stuff just works.
Yeah. It's true. And like you said earlier, for some, they will, well, if I'm really angry, then what if people don't respond to that? So I'm just going to act like someone who's angry.
Well, that's right.
And then
I'm going to indicate
that's right.
anger
right.
with my angry face
right.
and all of this stuff. And I'll, if I'll do this, you're so angry. No, instead of just being in there and letting that thing just organically happen.
Exactly. Yeah. When you think of all the acting classes of, you know, you'll see an actor who's not getting there. So he throws a chair or throws something in the scene at, you know, in class, and you're going, okay, so you threw a chair, but really I'm still not seeing the anger. I'm seeing you throw a chair.
Right, right.
I'm not buying that,
right.
you know. And that's where, yeah, I guess the, you know, it separates the men from the boys, the ones that truly can come up with that yeah. and make it real.
Yeah.
You know.
And when we, and well, in my last thing, because I've heard this story from you before, in talking about opposites, which is something in acting school that they talk about, which is the unexpected, when you're supposed to cry, to laugh, to
right.
do something that is unexpected, which sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes can create an actually authentic moment.
Right.
Like something hits a human being in just such an odd way that it actually it's almost more real than that indicated thing. And it was the Nick Colasanto story of the actor friend that you knew who was getting news that someone had died.
Yeah. It was
Nicholas Colasanto played a coach mm-hmm. on Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
He was an older man who was wonderful as coach, but who many people didn't know was, you know, quite a prominent television director. Yeah. And the actor was on the set that you told me. And was it that his mother had died or something?
In the scene, and I can't remember, you know how Chips would, they would do, the, like each guest star would have like a 15-minute piece.
Mm-hmm.
And this
was on your Chips.
This was on my Chips,
yeah.
The actor, I forget what it was, but Nick wanted him to cry.
Right. Needed it was tears. Some news. You're getting
yes.
news.
I think his dad had died or his mom had died.
And you're just given this news.
Right.
And you need to cry
yes.
right now.
And this actor happened. We had both been studying with the same teacher at this time. Charles Conrad
mm-hmm.
Was trying. And Charles took, actually, that was my first exposure to the Meisner work. Meisner has an exercise called the repeat exercise. Charles kind of based his whole technique kind of off this moment-to-moment technique, which really worked great for film and everything, but it's kind of whatever comes up for you. Even though you're hearing about your dad's death or mom's death, if you feel like laughing, that's interesting because that could be a real honest response. We'll find out later why.
Right.
So,
but on television, that's not what they want.
That's right. Time is money,
yes.
and he needed tears.
And even in movies, I'll tell you, that's not what they want, unless you are a huge movie star,
right.
and they have time to go through your process like that. On a television show, on Chips, they're saying, and then, actor, you find out your dad dies, and then you cry.
Right.
And he reacts how?
Yeah, so the actor comes to the point where whatever he's supposed to cry, and he starts laughing. And Nick goes, cut. Let's do that again. So remember your mom or dad, whatever the site, forget what that was. Your mom and dad died, so let's take this seriously. And starts again. He starts laughing again. And Nicholas comes over to him and says, look, I don't have time to mess with this. I need, or something like that. He says, I need you to cry. And he's going, well, that's not what's coming up for me is I'm laughing. And he goes, I don't care what's coming up for you. I need you to cry. And they have this little moment, and Nicholas through, kind of pushed him up against the, it took place in the, he was a fellow highway patrolman, gets pushed up against the lockers, and he says, honestly, I don't have time to fuck around with this. Let's, you know.
So he gets, the director pushes him, against
the, didn't, you know, hurt him.
Yeah,
you know.
But he's saying, but he was, look, this is the business I'm in.
That's right.
I'm doing chips right now. That's we don't have the time. When he says that, you cry. That's your job.
That's right.
Roll the camera.
Yeah. And that's what he cried the next time. But yeah, God bless Nick Colasanto. What a sweet guy that.
But what can I can I go off of acting for a moment?
Sure.
Because when you were a kid, you had this job. You were a delivery boy.
Oh, deliver flowers, yeah.
For what florist?
Sonny Alexander Florists in Beverly Hills.
So you were a delivery boy for a Beverly Hills florist.
Yeah, yeah.
Which got you, well, I've heard from you a couple, but I don't know, it's some very interesting experiences.
Yeah, well, of course, being, you know, a Beverly Hills flower shop, you deliver to Bel Air and Holmby Hills, and I'd go to a lot of producers and, you know, directors' houses, actors' houses. But what you're, I think, leading to is I did deliver flowers to Alfred Hitchcock one day, and it was his birthday, apparently. And what's funny is back then, you know, the people who could easily tip you, give you a dollar or whatever, would never be the ones that would – you'd get it from the old Jewish lady, let's say, who didn't have it.
So the big stars, the big Beverly Hills people, never a dollar.
Never, never. And what was funny, you could have many – most of the time they would say, yeah, go around back and set it by – they have like a delivery area at these mansions.
So, the Beverly Hills mansion.
Right. So you would see – sometimes I'd see maybe 40, 50 arrangements there.
No, not 40 or 50.
I swear – I remember going to Howard Koch's house one time.
And big movie producer.
And I got – they didn't give me a tip. And I'm looking – there had to be 40 or 50, you know, arrangements for him, floral arrangements. And and I'm thinking, even at a dollar an arrangement, if they had tipped, you know, every delivery guy – it would have cost him $50.
Exactly, just to receive flowers.
That's right, just to receive. And anyway, so – yes, most of the time we wouldn't get tipped from those who could afford to tip. But I go to Hitchcock's house.
So you're knocking on Alfred Hitchcock's door.
And I give his butler, who I guess that would be assistant. Seemed like a butler to me. Came to the door, said one moment, and took the flowers apparently into the house. Came back out, and I thought he's going to – I'm thinking, oh, I'm getting a tip for one of the from a big mansion here. And he says, Mr. Hitchcock would like to know if you'd like to join him in a piece of birthday cake. And I, of course, said yes. And so I go into his house and
– so you're escorted to some Beverly Hills – Alfred Hitchcock's dining room?
Yeah. Well, you know, I just saw, by the way, Hitchcock is with
– the movie.
Yeah, the movie with Anthony Hopkins. And I was trying to remember – I should probably Google this because, you know, all the – I was at so many beautiful mansions.
Sure.
I remember this moment. But I don't remember if the house I wondered if they used the actual house in the movie because I can't remember the house. And but anyway, yes, he leads me into this dining room with a huge long table, and there is Alfred Hitchcock already sitting there with he's got his shirt on and tie and a napkin tucked into his collar, but the tie is up. It's not, you know, loose.
Yes, tied and everything.
Right. And he's sitting there already eating his birthday cake. At the far end of the table, opposite him.
Like, what, 60 yards away?
Right. It had to be, or, 50 chairs away,
right.
Whatever. There is a lone piece of birthday cake on a plate, and that's where the butler leads me. So I sit down. I look at Mr. Hitchcock, who does not look at me at all. I look up at the butler, and he motions, go ahead, eat. You know, so I
– he just gives you a motion, like a head, like, eat the piece of cake.
And I eat, and maybe – 3-4 bites and I'm done. And Mr. Hitchcock said nothing to me, and I look at him and
no eye contact. He's just eating his birthday cake.
He's eating. He's looking down, but he's got his jowly famous, you know, chewing. And I look up at the butler, and he gives me a motion. Okay, you had your cake, and let's go. And so I stood up and I look at Alfred Hitchcock, and I say, well, happy birthday, Mr. Hitchcock, and thanks for the cake. And that's when he looked up at me and just nodded, but he said nothing.
He didn't say anything, just a nod
just
of appreciation?
A nod. Right. Just an acknowledgement. Mm. And the butler leads me out, and I'm thinking, what was that? You know, what was what just happened? Was he putting me on, or is Alfred – I haven't heard much about Alfred Hitchcock lately. This is back then. Is he senile? Is he – you know. And I never knew. However, this was – 1970, probably 71, because I was still in high school. And then I started working as an actor in 77. So, and it was in 77 or 78, I went to Chasen's, famous restaurant, you know, and for the first time. And sitting in a booth, two booths away from me, is Alfred Hitchcock with Mae West. And they're having dinner. And I could see that he clearly is... You know, they're having conversation. So I realized, okay, back when, you know, years ago, Alfred was not senile. It was just he was either giving me a great story to tell, mm-hmm. at least, or a great moment for me. I looking back, I'm thrilled that he didn't say anything.
He didn't recognize you at Chasen's?
Yeah, right.
He didn't say, the one with the birthday cake.
Okay, right. Yeah, you have that. You have one of those. I had that thought. I mean, I would never do this, but to walk, hey, Al, yeah. Remember me? You had me for cake.
Happy birthday.
That's right. No.
And let me go to another soup, which I know, which is fascinating. But for many, many years, what every week, a dozen roses would appear on the gravesite of Marilyn Monroe. And no one knew who they were from for many, many, many years. They would just appear.
Yeah,
they would just be there every week. And I learned from you. I didn't know this until maybe a couple of months ago. You weren't buying them, of course. You were delivering the roses to Marilyn Monroe's grave.
Right, but I wasn't solely. I mean, you know, they other drivers would do it too. And I don't know. I know that I think they were called, I don't know if they're still around, Parisian florists had that account initially for Joe DiMaggio. Mm-hmm. But Sonny had it, I know, for at least a year. But yeah, many times I would, many weeks I would
deliver Joe DiMaggio's roses to Marilyn Monroe's grave.
And I think
it was years later that people actually figured out that it was Joe DiMaggio who was sending them.
Yeah, I think he did it for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think that was what he apparently really loved her, obviously, even though I think they were only married 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
That was a cool thing.
And of course, I'll skip over others. But you know, we have to know because people want to know. You delivered flowers to Elvis.
Actually, it wasn't flowers. But
what did you deliver to Elvis?
I worked at an antique store on.
Thought this was from the flower delivering.
Right. No. This was I worked at an antique store, and it was on the place called Martin of London. It was on the corner of Melrose and Kings Road, and. Priscilla would come in, and this was at the time that Elvis had already, this is probably, again, I not like 1970. I was in high school, and Elvis
this
was...
This is pre-fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches.
Yes, he was not heavy like it, but I think this might have been around the time she could have been having her, she was having, while he was in Vegas, she was with their karate teacher, a guy named Mike.
That was for karate training,
yeah, maybe
Jeff.
So. That's right.
Don't she has to defend? A woman
that's
has
right.
to defend herself.
That's you're right.
What is this with Jeff Harlan's War on Women?
Sorry.
What is this? I guess she can't defend herself with karate, but Elvis can.
Well, she could kick my butt. I'll tell you that.
So she bought a piece of art, an antique
furniture. Yeah, mm-hmm. She bought. They brought in. They bought a commode that we were mounting one of these hairstylist sinks in, and the, you know where you could put your. It's
well, your head for your shampooing head, right. And that stuff.
And back then, I remember this commode was around $3,000.
Holy mackerel!
And when I asked her, I said, "What is this? What are you guys going to do? Are you going to for washing your hair at the house?" She goes, "No, this is so we could bathe our dog." And I remember thinking. $3,000 to, you know, so you could bathe your dog. And,
with one of those head things? No way. She didn't want to say it. It was for black hair dye.
Yeah, maybe so.
Black hair dye, you're Jeff. Right. That's what it's for.
See, I was a gullible teenager. I believed her. But she was so gorgeous, and I had this little fantasy of just, you know, me thinking, anyone's nice to you, you know, and you're thinking, oh, she likes me, you know.
So Elvis, you showed up at Elvis's house?
When I delivered, yeah, we delivered the, or I delivered the piece.
Was it a big, was it a crazy, like a Graceland kind of house?
No, it was in Truesdale Estates, which is just off the Doheny Hills area. It wasn't even Bel Air, you know. But it was a nice house, but a simple house. When I say simple, nicer than probably anyone I'm going to have. But
right.
But it
but what I want to know is, was it bigger than Alfred Hitchcock's?
No.
Okay.
No.
Alfred Hitchcock 1, Elvis 0.
Right. From what I'm, if the film is true to, if that is his house, then no. This particular house, but Graceland is, even though it's small.
Sure, of course.
But I remember when I brought it up, I said to Priscilla, is Elvis here?
When you're at the house.
Yes.
So you're delivering the thing.
I'm delivering the thing, and I said, is Elvis here? I'd love to meet him. And she goes, no, but would you like to see his clothes? So she leads me into
She really says that.
She says that to me.
Would you like to see his clothes?
Right. And she leads me into their bedroom, and I'm thinking, again, this is the fantasy, you know, actor's fantasy. I'm thinking, wow, she's taking me into the bedroom. Elvis isn't here. I might really actually have my moment. As if.
Maybe you could have taught her karate.
Yeah, maybe.
Or something. I don't know.
Or she could have taught me. But she opens up this huge closet.
How old were you at this point? Were you actually think 16. That Priscilla Presley's coming on to you?
It's 16, ridiculous. 16.
And you're just thinking, yeah. This is my shot.
That's right. My shot. I'm going to get to. Yeah, that's right. She's going to take my virginity. Right. No, actually, I had lost it. But
she really showed you Elvis's clothes.
She showed me his clothes. And the clothes were on, like, you know, you go to the dry cleaners, that conveyor belt.
Oh, the thing that moves her.
Right. So she pushes a button, and all these sequin outfits were just flying by. And a cape, what a cape.
Elvis's cape whips by.
Right. And I said to her, I mean, he had many capes. And I said, do you think he'd mind if I took one? And she went, I think he would. You know,
And
that was it. That's my, pretty uneventful Elvis story. But what was really just pathetic is me thinking that, oh, she's taking me in the bedroom.
But you were a kid. But you got to look at Elvis's capes.
That's right. That's true.
With Priscilla in the big closet.
And she was, though, so, as you can imagine. This when you said the black hair dye, she had, at this point, gone back to her, like, red brunette or auburn color hair. But, gosh, she was so cute. And I had such a little crush on her.
Well, you are the official spokesperson of the Big Pop Fun podcast with Tom Wilson. So would you sign us off? In your professional, well modulated voice.
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think of some that we did. You've been well. Of course, now this is one you've been using.
Oh, really?
This isn't my typical Jeff Harlan voice.
Oh,
but you've been listening to Big Pop Fun with Tom and Jeff. Something like that.
Thanks very much for being on, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jeff Harlan and his stories. Boy, and then Alfred Hitchcock, I love that story. It's just so weird, so Hollywood. Anyway, thanks so much. Thanks so much for downloading the podcast. Keep listening, would you? Consider telling a friend or subscribing to the podcast. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody over at Nerdist Industries and the Nerdist Network. Thanks to McPherson Guitars, who helped me out with my beautiful guitar in the live show. Thanks to you, as I do all the time, as the holiday season comes upon us. I'm going to do, of course, the second annual Big Pop Fun Christmas special next week. Then we're going to take a rest for the new year, and then I'll come back, and it'll all be good. But thanks so much again. Talk to you soon.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.